All righty, we're underway then with session 18, starting on 140, page 140 of your notebook. So let's do a little bit of a review. We will actually, I promise you in a stack of Bibles, we will get to the end of section 3 tonight, the end of exile, 1839 to 1947, as we've looked at the modern Zionist movement. We will get there. We did this morning. All righty. Now, last week, we were looking at the fact that the extremists in the Zionist movement, Irgun, Etzel, the Stern Gang, etc., had finally come to the conclusion that if the British were allowed to oversee the mandate, they would do everything in their power to prevent the formation of the modern state of Israel. And so they came to the conclusion that they needed to resist the British in any way possible to make governing the land of Palestine the mandate as unpleasant as possible. And so they began terrorist attacks. And one of the most famous is the bombing of the King David Hotel. We talked about that last week here, and here's some of the remnants of that terrorist act. As that was going on, the British were restricting any kind of immigration into Palestine, and so Aliyah Beit, Immigration Plan B, was in effect, where literally thousands of Jewish people were attempting to emigrate into the land, quote, illegally. And 26,000 Jewish refugees, one quarter of the 100,000 DPs that were in DP camps, were intercepted by the British and then put in internment camps on the island of Cyprus. And of course, this was made public to the world what exactly Britain was doing. The most significant event came when the UNSCOPE members were in Palestine looking at what the UN should do about the conflict. And the little Chesapeake Bay ferry, the Exodus 1947, left France for Palestine, escorted by no less than six British destroyers and a cruiser. And you can see why so much armed force was needed for this terrible little boat here. When they got to Palestine waters, they were the British moved in to board them. They were resisted, and when the British finally started ramming this boat with 4,500 men, women, and children aboard, threatening to sink it, then the refugees capitulated to the British. The Exodus 1947 was brought into Haifa Harbor, and the people were forcibly taken off the boat and eventually ended up back in Hamburg. But the UNSCOPE officials watched this. They were eyewitnesses to the Exodus 1947 event. It took 3 years, 3 months, and for 3 months all the news was broadcast to the world. And everyone was quite shocked the way the British were dealing with the refugees. And so the UNSCOPE members said this was the best evidence they could have that the Jewish people wanted and desired and needed a national home. So that was the ship that started a nation. Then we looked at a first-person account about a young man who was part of the resistance against the British. We talked to Ezra was interviewed by Greenspan in Against All Odds, Israel Survives. We saw that God worked a few miracles in his life, making him invisible during his time in the underground. We finished up by looking at the partition plan, UN Resolution number 181, voted on November 29, 1947, and adopted. The idea was to split everything west of the Jordan River into a Jewish and into a Arab country. And the blue country on the map here is the Jewish state, consisting of eastern Galilee at the top, then the seacoast from Haifa down to Ashkelon, and then the desert, the Negev, to the south, the Arab state being the western Galilee, the hills of Judea and Samaria, and then from Ashkelon down to the Egyptian border along the coast, and then take a left turn and a little bit ways down the Egyptian border. So that would be the two countries that the UN partition plan felt the area should be divided into, like two snakes coiled around each other in a death struggle, as this whole plan was described. Well, the Zionists weren't exactly happy with all this. The Jewish state was being shrunk even further. But the Jewish reaction was to accept the UN proposal and with great joy. The Arab reaction was something different, however, and that's where we pick it up on page 140 with the beginning of Arab attacks. Okay, everybody there? Page 140. The Arab reaction. Now, the initial response to the partition resolution was to carry out their often repeated threat of violence. It set a pattern for the months and the years ahead. Now, the Arab Higher Committee, remember we've talked about them earlier, proclaimed a three-day general strike from December 2nd to December 4th, 1947, and violence began immediately with attacks on Jewish quarters in Jerusalem, in Haifa, and in Jaffa. And this is just a representative picture of Haganah units defending the Jewish community in those towns. So the attacks had begun. Warfare had begun. Soon after, the Higher Committee began recruiting volunteers throughout Palestine Arab towns and villages. And the result was Arab militias. Their opening tactics were essentially hit-and-run assaults. They were hit-and-run assaults on isolated Jewish settlements, on transportation, and the pillage and destruction of Jewish property. Now, the next three sentences are worth marking up. This is a mark-it-up moment. If you've got a highlighter or something, highlight the next three sentences. Left to their own devices, Arab and Jews, for the most part, continued to live together peacefully, if fearfully. And you know, isn't that true? The average Palestinian, the average Israeli, just wants to make a living, live next door to their neighbor, live in peace, you know, raise their kids, go on vacation to Cyprus now and again. You know, that's the ambitions of the average Palestinian and average Israeli. It's always the extremists that cause the problem. So left to their own devices, the two communities would have lived peacefully together. Next sentence. The Higher Committee's violence alone would not have precipitated a full-scale war between the two peoples. But the Palestine Arabs and Jews were what? They were not left alone. Next sentence. During the September 16, 1947 meeting in Shofar, Lebanon, the Arab League, this is the Arab League made up of the Arab nations surrounding the whole area, the Arab League Political Committee appealed for economic reprisals against Britain and the United States and for money and weapons for the Palestine Arabs. Soon, an Arab Liberation Army was organized. And you notice, this was done by the Arab League. General Sir Ismail Safwat Pasha, an Iraqi staff officer, because the Iraq was part of this, was appointed as commander. Field command was invested in Fawzi al-Kawukji, you know, our good friend Fawzi. We ran into him earlier on. He was the guerrilla leader of the Palestine Civil War in 1936. And here's a picture of him on his Arabian steed. Beautiful horse. I don't know about the guy on it, but the horse is beautiful, isn't it? There's Fawzi. He was the field commander of the army, the Liberation Army. In January 1948, elements of the Liberation Army began infiltrating over the Palestine border. And remember, this is all happening in the 6 months between the adoption of Resolution 181 and the Declaration of the State of Israel. This is a six-month period. By the end of March, the number had grown to 7,000 soldiers. Assaults were launched against Jewish quarters in the cities, particularly in Jerusalem. There were concentrated attacks against outlying kibbutzim in the Hebron Hills. The Arabs succeeded during the period in cutting the roads between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, between Haifa and Western Galilee, between Tiberias and Eastern Galilee, between Afula and the Baisan Valley. Just to give you a geographical fix here, here is the nation of Israel. So the roads were cut between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. Roads were cut in this area. Between Haifa and the Western Galilee. up in that area, between Tiberias and eastern Galilee. And finally, Afula is in the middle of the Jezreel Valley, between Afula and the Beit Shan area, the Beit Shan Valley. So key roadways were all cut off by this time. And soon, settlements became isolated. In addition, Jewish farm colonies in the Negev to the south were soon isolated from the rest of Palestine. Now, in Jerusalem, the situation for the Jews was particularly grave. By the end of March 1948, as the gauntlet of Arab attacks from the hill areas became increasingly deadly, the entire Haganah convoy system was in danger of collapse. That's a convoy system bringing supplies to the various isolated towns and villages and Jerusalem. By then, too, the three roads leading to Jerusalem were in the hands of Arab irregulars, and the Jewish population in the city faced the imminent likelihood of being starved or overrun. So Jerusalem is under siege once again. Jerusalem has been under siege many, many times. Here's another time. In late 1947, once the United Nations decision for partition was assured, the Haganah leadership concentrated on two major objectives. The first was the security of the Yishuv against local Arab forces during this half-year period of British withdrawal. So they were first had to provide security against internal forces during this six-month period. And the second priority was defense of the country against a full-scale Arab invasion. This is external forces. So they had to deal with the internal forces and prepare for a full-scale invasion by the external Arab armies. And that would happen on May 15th. That's exactly what they were anticipating and exactly what would happen. All right, in the middle of page 141, we come to the topic of the Arab refugees. There were other changes in the configuration of Israel at this time. Remember, this is the six-month period where the British mandate is still in effect, but the British are doing everything they can to get out of the country. Very confusing time, a very stressful time for everybody. So there were other changes in the configuration of Israel. These were demographic rather than political or geographic. Now, the first of two phases took place in the months immediately following the partition resolution. Approximately 30,000 Arabs decided to leave Palestine. Note who these emigrants were. Most of these emigrants were businessmen and their families from the larger cities. So the economy, the Arab economy, is now being directly affected by these businessmen leaving the country, voluntarily leaving the country. Okay? Note that. In April and May of 1948, as the Jews began to secure the upper hand in Palestine, Arab public services collapsed in the pandemonium of the British evacuation. The exodus of Arab families resumed, and this time it included large numbers of communal officials, village mayors, qadis, those are the Muslim priests, and judges. Thousands of fellahin, that word fellahin describes the peasant farmer. The fellahin is the peasant farmer. Thousands of fellahin and town dwellers began to accompany them. The most dramatic episode of the flight during this second phase of the Arab departure occurred in Haifa. Approximately 70,000 Arabs lived in this harbor city. On the afternoon of the 22nd, the Jewish mayor of Haifa and his colleagues met with the Arab leaders and pleaded with them to remain in the city with their fellow townsmen. That same afternoon, the reply was conveyed to the mayor and to his associates that the Arabs would not live for a single day under Jewish rule. Now that strikes me as kind of funny because they were living under Jewish rule. It was the Jewish mayor. You know, kind of strikes me as odd that that would be their reason. Within 36 hours, the remaining Arab population that had not already gone, 30,000 souls, left the city and departed for Lebanon, either by overland or by sea. That's a lot of people in just a few days, isn't it? 30,000. Elsewhere, the Arab exodus began gaining momentum, reaching nearly 175,000 during the last weeks of the mandate, toward the end of the six-month period. Now, there were various reasons for the flight, but none of them can be traced to an alleged appeal for evacuation by the Arab governments themselves, ostensibly to make way for the impending invasion of the Arab armies. Now, this was a frequently repeated Israeli claim after the war. Now, for example, this claim has also been repeated long after the war. For example, in Israel, My Glory, April-May 1991, on page 8, you read this. Arab heads of state had warned repeatedly that the Jewish agency exercised their right to proclaim a new nation. Then the Jews would be pushed into the sea by the Arab juggernaut poised at the borders. These Arab leaders had repeatedly told civilian Arabs living near Jewish areas to abandon their homes, assuring them that they could return to them after the sure Jewish bloodbath. So there is one account of this idea. The voluntary Arab exodus had begun. By the way, it was a voluntary exodus, but the reasons for it are rather cloudy, as you'll see in just a few minutes. Hundreds of thousands had already left their homes in Jaffa, Haifa, Lydda, Ramla, and parts of Jerusalem. So there is Israel, My Glory, supporting this idea of the Arab countries virtually ordering their citizens to leave Palestine. This is also supported in the Atlas of the Arab-Israeli Conflict, Martin Gilbert, page 47. The United Nations estimated that over 725,000 Arabs fled from Palestine between April and December of 1948. The Israelis estimated that between 550,000 and 600,000 Arabs fled. So there's quite a bit of difference in the estimates. Many Arabs were encouraged to leave by their own political leaders, who promised them that they would soon be able to return to their homes once Israel had been destroyed. So again, the Atlas of the Arab-Israeli Conflict supports this idea. And in The Complete Idiot's Guide to the Arab-Israeli Conflict, page 179, you read this. In his memoirs, Khaled al-Azm, the Syrian prime minister in 1948 and 1949, also admitted the Arab role in persuading the refugees to leave. Quote, "Since 1948, we have been demanding the return of the refugees to their homes, but we ourselves are the ones who encourage them to leave." All right, so that's one side of the story. Now, back to your notes here. According to Howard Sachar, however, no such order for evacuation was ever found in any release of the Arab League or in any military communique of the period. Rather, the evidence in the Arab press and radio of the time was to the contrary. By and large, the Arab League ordered the Palestinians to stay where they were, and stringent punitive measures were reported against Arab youths of military age who fled the country. Even Jewish broadcasts in Hebrew mentioned these Arab orders to remain. Asim Pasha, Abdullah, and the various national committees appealed repeatedly to the Arabs not to leave their homes. In Ramallah, the Ramallah commander of the Arab Legion threatened to confiscate the property and blow up the houses of those Arabs who left without permission. At one point, the Lebanese government decided to close its frontiers to all Palestinians except women, children, and the aged. So you see, this issue is very controversial. What exactly happened there? I can't give you a clear-cut opinion regarding one side or the other, but I have a feeling that it's probably a little bit of both. Probably a little bit of both, and each side probably exaggerated the side that they were most interested in. So probably all of that went on. But that the Exodus was voluntary is very clear. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Now, the next three, next paragraph and the next three sentences or so are important, because I think I think Sakhar probably hits on probably the best reasoning regarding the causes of this Arab exodus. This is probably the best explanation of it. The most obvious reasons for the mass exodus was the collapse of Palestine Arab political institutions that ensued upon the flight of the Arab leadership at the very moment when that leadership was needed. Remember, the businessmen left first, and then came the communal leaders. That's probably the genuine reason for the refugee exodus. The departure of the Mukhtars, the judges, and the like from Haifa and from the new city of Jerusalem, from Jaffa, Tzfat, and elsewhere, dealt a grave blow to that Arab population. The semi-feudal character of Arab society rendered the illiterate fellah, remember the peasant farmer, the fellaheen, rendered the illiterate fellah almost entirely dependent on the landlord. And once this was gone, the Arab peasant was terrified by the likelihood of remaining in an institutional and cultural void. So I think that's the best reason. That's the major cause for the voluntary refugee exodus. The business, the Arab business community collapsed, the Arab economy collapsed, and then the Arab culture collapsed. All their community institutions, as the leaders voluntarily fled the country. So what are the peasants to do? They're to follow them as well. So I think that's the best explanation. However, question, yes?
When you talk about the Arab culture, at this time, was Islam big with them now?
Oh, yes. The Arabs have been followers of Islam since 700 AD. So, yes.
So you didn't see the kind of atrocities that we see today?
Well, when the Arab armies conquered the Middle East and the North Africa and into Spain, they were pretty brutal.
But these Arab attacks were not like that.
What do you mean?
We were just reading about the Arab attacks.
Yes.
Yes, they weren't like beheadings and things like that.
Oh, no, I don't think so, no. But they were killing people.
Yeah,
people were dying, yes. All righty. Now, notice the next sentence. Jewish victories obviously intensified the fear and accelerated departure. You know, the Israelis took advantage of this. In many cases, Jews captured Arab villages, expelled the inhabitants, and blew up houses to prevent them from being used as strongholds against them. In other instances, Kawukji's men used Arab villages for their bases, provoking immediate Jewish retaliation. Now, Arab leaders gave wide publicity to authentic or rumored acts of atrocity committed by the Zionist enemy. So they propagandized this, and you know the propaganda worked in favor of Israel, worked in favor of the Zionists. In April and May, entire Arab communities were fleeing in terror even before Jewish forces overran their homes. So they used the propaganda to their own advantage. June 11, when the first UN truce came into effect, some 250,000 Arabs had fled the Jewish-occupied areas of the country. Now, once on the offensive, Israel changed its policy toward the local Arabs. And of course, this is a little overlap after the War of Independence. No effort, once Israel is on the offensive, no effort was made to persuade them to stay and to share in the anticipated benefits of the Jewish state. By spreading warnings ahead of them, making use of that Arab propaganda, the Jews ensured that most Arab settlements were evacuated before the Israeli army arrived. So again, the Zionists are taking advantage of all the propaganda spewing out of the Arab countries. The number of Arab immigrants reached 300,000 by July 9th. After hostilities ended, the UN placed the number of Arab fugitives from Israeli-controlled territory at approximately 720,000, or 70% of the Arab population. 70% had left. Jewish estimates were 538,000. Now, 180,000 refugees fled toward the Gaza area. And the fate of these Gaza derelicts were particularly cruel. They were refused employment. They were refused resettlement by Israelis and Egyptians. The Egyptians did not absorb them at all. For the next generation, they were destined to vegetate in a confinement as tragic as that endured by the Jewish displaced persons in Europe between 1945 and 1948. Now, page 143, I've given you this map of the Palestine refugee movement during this six-month period before the War of Independence, and you can see the major areas of Arab exodus from Haifa, north up into Lebanon, from the Haifa area, from the Jaffa area, and south from in the Beersheba area. These are the major areas of Arab exodus at this time. And also the map on 143 shows you the UN refugee camps that were set up for these poor souls. And all those little red triangles, not so easy to see. They're not in red on your map. They're in black. But on the screen, the little red triangles are the refugee camps that were set up in the West Bank, in Gaza to the south there, in Lebanon, in Syria, and in Jordan. Now, you also have a picture of the refugees at the top of the page, some refugees on the march, top of page 143. Now, here's another. I've got some more pictures of that. Here's some Arab refugees, again, heading toward an Arab country and expecting to be safe there. Notice that truck in the background. He's got a flat tire. He can't go anywhere, but notice he's piled high with personal goods. Piled high with personal goods. And here's that picture you have in your notes of Arab refugees on the move. Here's a picture of one of the refugee camps early on. These refugee camps had to be thrown up rather quickly with all these thousands and thousands of people. And so tents were thrown up. So huge tent cities were constructed to hold these refugees. Yes?
On the map, the official number of Palestinian refugee camps, November 1993.
Yeah, that's the map. That's the refugee camps that still exist. They still exist. Yes, that's my next point. See, the refugee camps were set up originally as tent cities, like here, but they've been there for 66 years. They've been there for 66 years. They're no longer tent cities. Here is a Palestine refugee camp in Jabal al-Hussein in Jordan. One of those refugee camps in Jordan. No longer a tent city, but it's its own little built-up mini-city all in itself. Yes? They're not allowed to become residents of Jordan, no. The Palestinian refugees are kept in these camps, and they're not allowed to assimilate into the surrounding Arab country.
And they're kept there by other Arabs?
They're kept there, yeah. I'll talk about this in just a moment, yes. So these refugee camps still exist. And again, no longer tent cities, but little mini cities, built-up cities all by themselves. There's an example of one of them. Now, here's the Gaza Strip. You can see its location in the inset map there. The dark red areas on the slide are the refugee camps proper. The pink areas are the built-up areas. And so Gaza City is literally a city now, and Rafah, etc. You hear about these places, Khan Yunis. So these are really now built-up refugee camps. And, of course, this is where the rockets are always being shot into southern Israel, here from the Gaza Strip. All righty. Now, turn to page 144. And we have a few comments by Joseph Farah. WorldNet Daily editor Joseph Farah writing about his Mideast Truth Tour, October 2002. Here's what he said. The revised history has given the guilty a free ride, he said. The Arab states that initiated the hostilities by, of course, refusing to accept UN Resolution 181, the Arab states that have initiated the hostilities have never accepted responsibility despite their enormous wealth, and their ability to assimilate tens of millions of refugees into their largely underpopulated nations. Think of Iraq, think of Saudi Arabia with their petrodollars, for example. Despite their enormous wealth and their ability to assimilate tens of millions of refugees in their largely underpopulated nations, and other states have failed to hold them accountable. Europe, the United States, we have not held them accountable for this. The UN just gives them money to support these refugee camps. It's bad enough the Arab states created a small nation of refugees by their actions. It's worse that they have successfully blamed that international crime on the Jews. Today, of course, this cruel charade continues. The suffering of millions of Arabs is perpetuated only for political purposes by the Arab states. They are merely pawns in the war to destroy Israel. There were some 100 million refugees around the world following World War II, he said. How many Palestinian refugees? 750,000, okay? Not even 1 million, in contrast to the 100 million refugees around the world. The Palestine Arab group is the only one in the world not absorbed or integrated into their own people's lands. Okay? They're still there. There's no other refugee camps left over from World War II. Since then, millions of Jews, of Jewish refugees from around the world have been absorbed into the tiny nation of Israel. We're 7.5 million Jews now in Israel, something like that. It makes no sense to expect that the same tiny Jewish state representing just 0.1% of the Mideast landmass to solve a refugee crisis it did not create. So I thought those were good points, very good points. This refugee crisis is something that has been manufactured by the Arab states. All righty. Now, before we move on to page 145, I'm going to spend the second half of our class here doing a little bit of a theological review, just going over some of the material we went over in detail some 18 weeks earlier, okay? So what I'll have you do now is go ahead and take your break, and we'll come back and we'll review some of the biblical background to all this. So go ahead and take your break and listen for the shofar, and we'll pick it up in 15 minutes.
And the review is for the midterm exam.
All righty, let's pick it up then with our theological review. Now, actually, what I don't want you to do is turn back to the opening pages. All this material is covered in pages 8 through 41 of your notebook. And I'm not going to go into it in detail. I'm just going to, you know, skim over it and review it. If you want to turn back there and try to follow along, that's up to you. But I think it'd be better if you just concentrated on what I have to say and on the charts that I put up, okay? So let's quickly take a look at the material we covered way back in the beginning. Way back in lesson number one, we started our theological background to the modern state of Israel by asking the question, what is Zion? And we answered that question a number of ways. First of all, Zion originally was the southeastern hill of Jerusalem, the hill in between the Kidron Valley on the east and the Tyropian Valley on the west. So this is the original definition of Zion. Then the definition got expanded. Later, the Temple Mount to the north of the southeastern hill was added under the definition of Zion. Eventually, all of Jerusalem was included in the definition, what is Zion? Then all of Judah. And finally, all of the Jewish people can be sometimes found under the definition of Zion. So the word Zion has a broad definition. You've got to look to the context to decide what Zion you're talking about. So there's many, at least five definitions of Zion. So what is Zion? That was our first question. I've given you the answer to that. The next question is, what is Zionism? And this is the definition we proposed. The word Zionism describes a feeling. Zionism is an expression of the longing and yearning that the Jewish people have had in the past and still have for their homeland. As soon as any Jew expresses a desire to go back to his land, he is expressing Zionism. And this definition is supported by sections of Scripture, especially Psalm 137, verses 1 through 6. Good support for that definition. By the rivers of Babylon. So the community has been exiled to Babylon by Nebuchadnezzar. And they're living in the rivers that surround Babylon, the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and wept. Now you can see the emotional element coming in. When we remembered Zion. Upon the willows in the midst of it, we hung our harps. For there our captors demanded of us songs, and our tormentors mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. And the Jewish response to this torment, how can we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem. So now you see Zion and Jerusalem are synonymous terms in the psalmist's mind. If I forget you, O Jerusalem, may my right hand forget her skill. May my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth. If I do not remember you, if I do not exalt Jerusalem above my chief joy. So you can see two aspects of the definition of Zion there. You can also see the emotional aspect, the longing for to return to our land, the land where Jerusalem is our capital city. And then the commitment to remember where we came from, to remember our holy land, to remember our holy city, never to forget it and to return to it. So Psalm 37 is a good support for the term, the definition of Zionism. Now, a critical bit of information that you need to master is the Abrahamic covenant. You're probably just tired of me always bringing the Abrahamic covenant before you. But if you understand the Abrahamic covenant, you will understand the Bible. So you have to keep it in mind. So let's review it very quickly. So the Abrahamic covenant was a covenant God entered into with Abraham in Genesis 12, repeated in 13, 15, and 17. The Abrahamic covenant was then passed on to Isaac, not Ishmael. Remember, Abraham had two sons. Only one received the covenant, Isaac in Genesis 26. It was then confirmed through Jacob, not Esau. Remember, Isaac had two sons. Jacob received the covenant in Genesis 28. But then it was confirmed not to one son, but to all 12 sons, all 12 tribes in Genesis 49. And that's where the Abrahamic covenant comes down to Jewish people today, because we're all members of one of the 12 tribes. Now, this is also the biblical definition of who is a Jew. Now, this is a question that plagues the Jewish community, has always plagued the Jewish community. Who is a Jew? You would think that that question would be a simple one to answer, but we're having trouble with it. But the biblical definition of who is a Jew is derived from the material there on the left-hand side of the chart. A Jew is a descendant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It is a family relationship, according to Amos 3:2. For example, the Arabs are descendants of Abraham, but they're not Jews, because they're not descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Okay? The Edomites are descendants of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, but the covenant was not confirmed to the Edomites. They were descendants of Esau. It was confirmed to all 12 tribes. So you have to be a descendant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and be part of that family. Amos 3:2. And here's Amos 3:2. You only have I chosen, there's the idea of the chosen people, you only have I chosen from what? All the families of the earth. Therefore, I will punish you for your iniquities. So there's God's view of populations. Populations are viewed as families from God's point of view. And you notice, since we are the chosen people, we have received the double blessing. But with double blessing comes double responsibility. And with double responsibility comes double punishment for failure. It's not always fun to be a Jew, okay? Therefore, I will punish you for your iniquities. God does not punish all the families of the earth in the same manner that he deals with us. And he deals with us more severely because we've received greater privilege. Does that make sense? Okay. All right. The Abrahamic covenant in its basic form consisted of three basic promises. The land promise, it's a twofold promise. Of course, it's the promise of the tract of land we call Israel today. It's a twofold promise to you, Abraham, and to your descendants. Second promise is the national promise. Again, twofold. National election, you're the chosen people, and your nation will experience a unique relationship with the Gentile nations that surround her. I will bless those that bless you. I will curse those that curse you. Not said of any other nation in the world except the Jewish people. The third promise is the spiritual blessing promise. I will bless you, and you will bless others. Again, a twofold promise. Now, the Abrahamic covenant is eternal and unconditional. We learn by studying it. And the three promises of the Abrahamic covenant are expanded and developed by three additional eternal and unconditional covenants God made with the Jewish people. Okay, four eternal and unconditional covenants here. So the first promise, the land promise, is expanded and developed by the land covenant of Deuteronomy 29 and 30. The national promise is expanded and developed by the Davidic covenant, 2 Samuel, 1 Chronicles, Psalms 89, for example. And the spiritual blessing promise is expanded by the new covenant of Jeremiah 31:31, Ezekiel 36, etc. Now, the covenant that we are most interested in this class today is the land covenant, because this provides the basis for Jewish ownership of the land and Jewish return to the land. So in light of that, let's take a quick overview of the land covenant. Here it is in summary, not in detail. You can get the details in your earlier notes. First aspect the scripture talk about is that this is a distinct covenant, Deuteronomy 29:1. It is made on the plains of Moab. It was not entered into at Mount Horeb. The Mosaic covenant was entered into at Mount Horeb. But the land covenant is entered into on the plains of Moab. Okay, a distinct, different covenant. Secondly, verses 2 through 29 deals with Israel's history, and unfortunately, our history is marked by disobedience. This is one of the reasons why I believe the scriptures are inspired. If I was writing about my family, I wouldn't write about the fact that we're stiff-necked, stubborn, and disobedient. Would you? No, we're godly and we're powerful and we're wonderful. If you want to read the Bible from a human perspective, read Josephus. All right? Read Josephus. Because he has an excuse for every sin and every bit of disobedience we go through. There's always some kind of good reason why we do what we do. Okay? So read Josephus. You'll get a very different perspective on Jewish history. But it's the Bible that's the truth. All right, so our history, unfortunately, is marked by disobedience, and it is marked by disobedience today. The third aspect that the land covenant talks about is the fact of dispersion. Because of our disobedience, we will eventually be dispersed worldwide. But the promise comes that at the end of that worldwide dispersion, we will repent of our sins. And then comes aspect number four, restoration, in chapter 30, verses 3 through 10. This deals with Israel's future. It deals with the Messianic kingdom. We will be restored permanently to the land. Now, a lot of details are left out of the land covenant. A lot of the details that we will learn as we study the prophets and other sections of Scripture. But this is the broad overview of the land covenant. Now, again, let me review. There are basically two types of covenants God made with the Jewish people. One type, well, you could call the Abrahamic type, and the Mosaic type. Okay, the Abrahamic type covenant, the Abrahamic covenant is, first of all, eternal. It will last forever. Second of all, it's unconditional. There are no conditions placed upon the Jewish people for the fulfillment of the covenant. It isn't dependent on what we do or don't do. God alone will see to the fulfillment of the covenant. Therefore, the covenant is unilateral. It is up to God alone. If it was up to us, would we be able to fulfill it? No. How come you guys are so quick on that answer? Okay. Right. We could never fulfill it if it was up to us. So it has to be unilateral. The purpose for the Abrahamic covenant is the place of blessing. This is the olive tree. in the book of Romans. It's the place of blessing for Jew and Gentile alike. All right, the other type of covenant then is the Mosaic covenant. The Mosaic covenant, in contrast, instead of being eternal, is temporary. It will totally disappear soon. It is conditional. There are responsibilities upon the Jewish people to keep the covenant. And you know, we have broken it over and over again. And God states that. We have broken the Mosaic covenant. And therefore, it is bilateral. There are conditions on both parties. And the purpose for the Mosaic covenant, it's a temporary administrator of the Abrahamic covenant. You see, when we came out of Egypt, we were now no longer a nation. We were no longer a family. We were a nation of 2 million. We needed a constitution. We needed laws. We needed rules and regulations to govern the behavior of 2 million people. And so the Abrahamic covenant was then administered to through the Mosaic covenant. The Mosaic covenant consisted of those laws, those regulations, to regulate the behavior of the people in this nation. 613 Mosaic laws. Okay, does that make sense? But it is a temporary covenant. Now, remember, always keep these two covenants separate in your mind. Now, many Christians don't, and some schools squish these two covenants together. What happens when you squish those covenants together? Confusion. Confusion. How come God says one thing here and another thing there? Okay? So always, always keep these covenants separate. They're two very different and distinct covenants. Right? Make sense? All right, that'll be on your test next week. Now, it is the Abrahamic covenant that you and I live under today. We live under the regulations of the new covenant, the spiritual blessing promise. And the details of the new covenant are found in what? The New Testament that you have in your hands. That's what New Testament means. It just means the new covenant. It's a reference back to Jeremiah 31, 31 and following. So the commands of the New Testament, the commands of the new covenant, the commands of the spiritual blessing promise is what is the rule of life for the believer today, Jew and Gentile alike. This is what we live under. All right? We don't live under the Mosaic covenant. The Mosaic covenant is holy and righteous and good, but it is and relevant, but it is not required as our rule of life today. Does that make sense? It's holy, it's righteous, it's good, it's relevant. You can learn a lot about God and His mind through reading the Mosaic covenant, but it is not required. It is not your rule of life today. Your rule of life today are the 600 plus commands of the New Testament. 600 plus commands. Okay? Excuse me? Yes, I do. I can provide you with a printout. One of my students did do. Would you like a copy?
Yes.
Sheesh. Do you realize how thick that is?
How many pages is it?
Well, it's many, many pages. All right. It's no small task. Well, I'll think about maybe how I can get it to those of you who are interested. Email.
Disk.
Disk, email. Okay, hang on. We'll talk about it. All right. Question.
Is there something... I'm trying to find that particular commandment that says something?
No, I think this may not be in your notes. It may be up front here in a handout. Okay? So if you don't see it in your notes, look up here for a handout. Okay, so we live under the Abrahamic covenant today, the spiritual blessing promise. The unbelieving Jewish community, those Jewish people who have not received Yeshua as their Savior and their Messiah and entered into the spiritual blessing promise, still live under the Mosaic covenant today. Okay, and that's 99% of us. We have not moved out from the Mosaic covenant. We are still under its conditions, the blessings and cursings of the Mosaic covenant. So remember that. That's where the nation of Israel lives today. That's where the Jewish community here in Southern California is today. We live under the conditions of the Mosaic covenant. Now let's take a quick look at those blessings and cursings. They are found in Leviticus 26, also in Deuteronomy 28. And we will fly through Leviticus 26 here. The chapter begins with an enumeration of the blessings. First of all, in chapter 26, verses 1 and 2, God states that obedience is required. It is a conditional covenant. We are to obey God. In verses 3 and 4, God explains the conditional nature of blessing. If you obey me, then I will bless you. And then we start in verses 5 through 10 with the blessings. If you obey me, I will bless you with prosperity, with security, with peace. If you continue to obey me, I will bless you in verses 11 through 13 with my presence. What could be better than that, huh? If we are continually obedient to God, He would walk among us. And now the blessing section is over. And the rest of the chapter deals, unfortunately, with our disobedience. So now we come to the curses of the Mosaic Covenant. Verses 14 through 17. However, if you disobey me, I will smite you with sickness, harassment, and insecurity. In verses 14 through 17. If you still disobey me, I will then smite you with drought and famine. In verses 18 through 20. If you still disobey me, I'll turn the screws down even tighter and I will send wild animals among you. And you will suffer from their attacks. Now all of these curses were experienced before and during the Assyrian invasions. So here's a timeline. From the book of Judges through the Assyrian invasions, we suffered sickness, harassment, insecurity, drought, famine, and wild animals. Sounds a little bit like the modern state of Israel today, doesn't it? All except for the wild animals part. And we are in disobedience. All right, back to Leviticus. In verses 23 through 26, if you still disobey me, I'll turn the screws down even tighter and you will experience the horrors of siege. This was experienced during the Assyrian and Babylonian invasions. Back to the timeline. Our cities were put under siege. Back to Leviticus. In verses 27 through 33, if you still continue to disobey me, you'd think we'd get the message by now. No. Wouldn't you? But no. We're stubborn, stiff-necked people. If you still continue to disobey me, you will experience devastation, deportation, dispersion, and cannibalism. You will eat your children. Now, if that doesn't set you back, I don't know what does. But these curses were experienced during the Babylonian and Roman destructions. Again, back to the timeline. The Babylonians and Romans devastated us, deported us, dispersed us, and cannibalism was experienced during those attacks. Back to Leviticus. In verses 34 through 35, now God describes the state of the land during the deportation, resting and desolate. This was experienced after the Babylonian destruction for 70 years, and after the Roman destruction for 2,000 years. And it's come to an end right now. So back to our timeline. The state of the land is resting and desolate. Do you notice the arrowheads are getting bigger and bigger? That's just to graphically illustrate that the discipline is getting more and more severe. That's the purpose for the bigger arrowheads. All right, back to Leviticus. Leviticus 36 through 26, 36 through 39. Then the state of the people is described. Fearful, weak, dispersed, persecuted. And this was experienced after the Roman destruction. This was not our experience in Babylon. In Babylon, we prospered. In fact, so few Jews wanted to go back to the land when the exile was over. Very few wanted to come back to the land. So this was experienced after the Roman destruction. After the Roman destruction, we were persecuted. And again, here comes our timeline. The people are fearful, weak, dispersed, and persecuted. Now, so we turn our attention back to Leviticus in verses 40 through 46. The curses of the covenant comes to an end with a promise of restoration. The Jewish people are promised restoration. And it'll be a restoration from a worldwide dispersion. Worldwide. That's your key word. And so now, Moses jumps ahead to the Messianic Kingdom. And he describes the restoration and the peace and the end of suffering. But you notice there's a big gap between the Roman destruction and the Messianic Kingdom, right? One more discipline remains for us. And the most severe discipline, the Antichrist destruction and the tribulation diaspora. This is what lies before us. Make sense? We, our class, on the first regathering modern Israel, is placed right there, in between the Roman destruction and the Antichrist destruction. Okay, we are back in the land, we're in unbelief, but we're heading for the tribulation period. Okay, make sense? That's where our class is taking place. Now, another key term to understand is the term the times of the Gentiles. We learn about the times of the Gentiles in the book of Daniel. But Jesus defined the times of the Gentiles most succinctly in Luke 21:24, where he stated that Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. So when we look at the book of Daniel, we see that the times of the Gentiles begins with the Babylonian destruction of Jerusalem and the temple, and it extends all the way to the return of Yeshua and the setting up of the Messianic kingdom. So we are living in the times of the Gentiles right now. Jerusalem has been trodden down by the Gentiles in the past. It will be trodden down by the Gentiles in the future. The times of the Gentiles does not exclude temporary times of Jewish control and sovereignty over the city, such as the Maccabean times, when we threw off the Greek yoke, or today, where we've had temporary control of the city since 1967. Times of the Gentiles does not eliminate Jewish sovereignty over the city for a temporary period of time. But we know that Jerusalem will be conquered again by the Antichrist in the tribulation period, in the middle of the tribulation. So even if Jewish control extends till then, it's going to end with the coming of the Antichrist in the middle of the tribulation. So we are living in the times of the Gentiles right now. All right, now this blessing and cursing of the Mosaic Covenant can be seen very clearly in the principle of expansion and contraction. The principle of expansion is brought out in Deuteronomy 19, verses 8 and 9. Now, this is expansion and contraction of the borders of the land. In Deuteronomy 19, God says, "If the Lord your God enlarges your territory," so when we came into the land, we did not possess all of it, so he could enlarge it. "If the Lord your God enlarges your territory, just as he has sworn to your fathers," that's Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and gives you all the land which he promised to give to your fathers, so when we entered the land, we didn't possess all of it at first, "if you carefully observe all this commandment which I have commanded you today, to love the Lord your God and walk in his ways," then he goes on into the blessings, okay? So the principle of expansion is, if we obey God, we will prosper, our population will increase, and our territory will increase until it expands to the full extent promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That makes sense? So expansion is based upon blessing, is based upon obedience. All right? Now, the opposite of this is the principle of contraction, brought out in 2 Kings 10, 31 and 32. "But Jehu was not careful to walk in the law of the Lord." He didn't obey the Mosaic Covenant. He was an ungodly king. "The God of Israel, with all his heart, he did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, which he made Israel to sin." God's reaction? "In those days the Lord began to cut off portions from Israel." In other words, the enemies began to conquer tracts of land. Basically, God is saying, if you disobey me, I'm going to squeeze you down, and if I have to, I will squeeze you off of the land that I promised you. And that's what's happening here in 2 Kings 10, 31 and 32. Now, we can view this principle in action if we graph out possession of the land. So we have a time period on the left side and the approximate percentage of the promised land that we have possessed throughout history. Now, this is just my estimates, okay? Nothing more authoritative than that. We start out with Abraham. During Abraham's time, he possessed virtually none of the promised land, just a burial cave in Hebron. During the time of the judges, when we came out of the Exodus, we possessed perhaps 20% of the land. During the United Kingdom, especially under Solomon, Our territory expanded to approximately 70% of the land. Here is a map of Solomon's kingdom. Jewish possession of the land to its greatest extent to date. However, notice that the land goes all the way up to the Euphrates River, that yellow portion to the north. But if you can look on the what is that box called down there? On the key,
the legend.
There you go. The yellow area is only the area effectively under Solomon's economic control. We weren't really possessing it. We weren't really living in it. But we did have control of the land as far as the Euphrates River. But we did not control the land of Hamath, Phoenicia, or Philistia. So we did not possess all of the promised land during Solomon's kingdom. We have never possessed all of the promised land. We do not do so today. All right, so about 70% of the territory promised to us during the United Kingdom. Then the kingdom became divided, and the northern kingdom was wicked, and territory began to be chewed up by our enemies. The Assyrian conquest then destroyed the northern kingdom and sent the northern kingdom into exile. We lost more land. Then the Babylonians came in after, and in 586 we were deported into Babylon for 70 years, and we were back to possessing virtually none of the land. However, after 70 years, we returned and began to possess more and more of the land. During the Hellenistic period, the period of the Maccabees, our possession of the land expanded to about 40%. But then the Romans came in after the Greeks, and we lost more land. So in the first century, our possession of the land was down to about 20%. We rebelled against Rome, starting in 70 AD, and finishing up in 135 AD, the first worldwide dispersion. We're kicked out of the land by the Romans for some 2,000 years. So we're, again, possessing virtually none of the land. Make sense so far? That's the ancient possession of the land. Now a graph of modern possession of the land. We're in the first worldwide dispersion for 2,000 years. We're possessing, for all accounts and purposes, 0%. Then comes the first worldwide regathering. 1839 to 1948, we begin to buy back the land. We begin to possess it step by step. You've been watching that happen. Then in the War of Independence, where we're getting to right now, 1948, we gained approximately 30% of the land. With the Six-Day War in 1967, our ownership of the land increased to about 40%. It stayed pretty consistent through the Yom Kippur War, through the Lebanon War, through the Gulf War, and then came the peace process. In 1991, God began to chop away pieces of our land. We lost the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Where's it going to go in the near future? I can't predict that. I'm no prophet. Will we lose more land? Will we regain land? Who knows? We'll have to see what the Lord has in mind. But we do know that in the middle of the tribulation period, we will expect and we will experience the second worldwide dispersion. When the Antichrist again kicks us out of the land, we're dispersed all over the world. But that will come to an end 3.5 years later with the second worldwide regathering, where Yeshua returns, defeats our enemies, defeats his enemies, returns us to the land, and that restoration that promised is accomplished. And then we will possess 100% of the land that we've been promised. Okay, yes. The peace process began right after the Gulf War. Okay? Yeah, the whole Mideast was changed after the Gulf War. We'll get to that in 1991. Okay? Things changed a lot after that war. So, of course, our study deals with the first worldwide regathering. We finished this section, and the rest of our study will deal with modern Israel and the major events happening there. So you can see how our ownership of the land has increased and decreased over the years. Now remember, another concept you have to keep in mind, that there will be two worldwide regatherings of the Jewish people promised. The first one is in unbelief for the purpose of judgment. It will be experienced during the tribulation, Ezekiel 20, 33 through 38. The second worldwide regathering will be in faith for the purpose of blessing. This will be during the Messianic Kingdom, Isaiah 11, 11 and 12. These are some of the details we get as we study other sections of Scripture. So we're studying now the first regathering. That's why the name of this study. We are back in the land. We're in unbelief. We're heading for the tribulation. All right. Now, we can get a look at what's to expect in the future by looking at a chronological sequence of events. First of all, we can look at prophetic events that have taken place already. First of all, World War I and World War II occurred. World War I began the end of the age, right? World War I also provided the opportunity for the modern state of Israel. World War II dramatized the need for the modern state of Israel. Then the reestablishment of the state of Israel has occurred. That is needed for many prophecies to take place. And Jerusalem became under Jewish control. Again, needed for many prophecies to become fulfilled. So that has all been accomplished. But there are many prophetic events that have not taken place yet. The first one we should expect is the Russian invasion of Israel. This has not occurred yet. That will precipitate into the one world government. But the one world government will degrade into a worldwide 10 division kingdom, 10 kingdoms worldwide government. You see, one government can't control all the people in this world. There's too many cultural differences, too many different points of view. It ain't going to work. It'll degrade into 10 kingdoms. Out of the 10 kingdom worldwide government will come the Antichrist. That's when he will appear on the scene. And then there will be a period of peace and false security. And during that time of peace and false security, Israel will sign a 7-year covenant with the Antichrist, and that will begin the tribulation period. The signing of the 7-year covenant, yes. You probably do. If not, if you can't find it in your handouts, let me know. All right, and there's a number of prophetic events that this is the next one to expect, the Russian invasion of Israel. So as you look at Russia today, and you look at Iran, and you look at some of these nations that are involved in Ezekiel 38 and 39, this is coming together. All right, there are prophetic events that cannot be chronologically arranged. For example, the rapture of the church can happen in any moment. It can happen tonight, and we can avoid the 100-degree weather coming up in the next few days. But it probably won't. It can happen at any time. The rapture of the church has no preconditions. The worldwide blackout. There will be a worldwide blackout before the great and terrible day of the Lord. The return of Elijah before the great and terrible return of the Lord. We don't know when that'll happen. The third temple has to go up. All we know is that it will be up and functioning by the middle of the tribulation. That's all Scripture tells us. When will it go up? We don't know. Will we see it? Maybe. Maybe not. But those are prophetic events that we cannot stick in any kind of a chronological framework. There's just not enough information. All right, that brings us now to page 145. And the fourth section of your class, Israel Present. Now we're going to take a break next week and take a look at an hour-long video. So bring popcorn next week. All right. We're going to look at Abba Iban's classic work, Israel, A Nation Is Born. It's now distributed by Jeremiah Films. But we're going to take a look at the first part of this history of the nation of Israel. It'll be interesting to look at because you'll see some of these people you've just heard about. For example, you'll see Harry Truman being interviewed. And his comments on the modern nation. You'll see a lot of these people in action that we've only talked about. So that's what we'll do next week. It'll be an hour-long video, so come prepared to enjoy the movie. All right, that brings us to the end of our class tonight. I've kept you 5 minutes over, as usual, so I don't apologize for that. You just have to live with that. So let me pray, and I'll turn you loose. Father, again, we want to thank you for your work creating the modern state of Israel. And for the fulfillment of prophecy that we've seen take place in these current years. And we see that from all this, Lord, that you are in charge. So no matter where this world is going, it's going your way, whether it wants to or not. And help us to always remember that no matter which way our lives are going your way, whether we like it or not. So help us to look to you as our King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and trust you as we walk day by day through this world. And help us to be able to share this perspective and this outlook and trust in you with the world around us. And we ask this in Yeshua's name. Amen. All righty, we'll see you next week.